Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for coming along this afternoon to this discussion session with the emphasis on the discussion. I will introduce Jules, first of all. Jules has over 25 years actuarial experience in a broad range of areas and in a variety of roles. He is currently the Director of Enterprise Metrics and based in Melbourne. When I first read this, I thought it said Enterprise Motors and he was going off to do something weird, but Jules has wide experience providing business and actuarial consulting in superannuation, funds management and risk management. Since 2000, he's also been involved on an ongoing basis with international regulatory capacity building and with professional actuarial education through the University of Melbourne and the Institute of Actuaries Professional Education Programme for its Part 2 and Part 3 GRIS subjects. Jules is also an active industry participant and presenter. Jules commenced a four-year term as a member of the Council of the Institute of Actuaries Australia in January 2011 and is a member of the Institute's research and education committees. Hand over to Jules. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to start by saying I'd like this session to be interactive, and I'm looking for feedback and commentary, and I guess, you know, to be fair, both good and bad, because this is something of a work in progress in a number of directions, not least in the sense of deciding what actuaries are and what actuaries do is always an evolving process, so it's necessarily ongoing, but also my thoughts about it are developing. I've only had 20 years at it so far, so I've got a little while to go. And that leads me on to the heritage of this. And a long time ago now, I stood up, as one does, at a convention, and there was a discussion about education going on, about what we should do and what we shouldn't do and whether this piece of the syllabus should be longer than that piece of the syllabus. And I asked what seemed to me to be a pretty simple question, which is, if you are going to use an actuary, you know, what's the criteria for using an actuary as opposed to somebody else, an economist or, you know, whatever else it turns out to be? And I was actually naively expecting for there to be some nice, succinct solution to roll out. And the only thing that rolled out was a deathly silence. And I've spent a lot of time since then asking myself and asking other people the question, and it's not entirely silent, but it's not exactly vocal either. So the question that's sitting here is, you know, what's that skill set, you know, if you like, that we have as actuaries that make us actuaries that they, being the other professions, don't have? How do we distinguish ourselves? And it's not about being better or worse, I want to add right at the beginning. It's because we have a different skill set, right? So it's about identifying the differences, not about winning the game, if you like. And there's been a couple of issues that have come up just during the convention. I noticed that the tendrils of this issue are floating around all over the place. We heard on Monday, Seamus, you know, talking in the plenary, was talking about his role in boards. And what were the words he was using? Holistic. Synthesis. You know, this is where actuaries add value. The magic C word came up. Communication. Now, Desmond Smith in the same plenary, although I'm not sure he was thinking in this particular context, talked about his fear that the profession, particularly in his part, was going to be forced to be looking inwards because of the weight of regulation. But I was struck by the forced to be looking inwards. Well, leave a bit of a conjecture that we spend a lot of time doing that. Anyway, Ian Lachlan, for those of you who went to the risk appetite session yesterday, now he talked about the role of the actuary as the translator between the techies and the business people, right? Between the model makers and the decision makers. So there's a translator role sitting here. Pauline Blight Johnson yesterday talked in the last session. You know, she talked around curiosity as a key trait that she'd like to see. And that picked up on an outward-looking focus and a forward-looking focus. I mean, not least, she also introduced the magic idea of super actuary. I did note that Mr. Super Actuary, well, A, he was a mister, but B, he was dressed in blue and not in a brown cardigan, and he didn't look at his own feet. So, you know, he was going quite well. And I'd like to add to that question of curiosity, I think the other characteristic that's sitting behind a lot of what Pauline said is bravery. Having the courage of your convictions to go out and say it and put your money where your mouth is, and you might not be right all the time, but it sure beats not being right any of the time by doing nothing. So, you know, where are we going on this sort of question of what are our unique skills? I mean, there's not a lot of us, that's the other point. And if we aren't careful, we're going to get drowned. So, if this is going to work for me, is it going to work? How do I make this work? On the mouse?
Up on the presentation to start.
Oh, that one there.
No, under where you've got Google.
There? Him?
Yeah, him.
Oh, okay. All right, that'll work well.
Yeah.
All right, so there's a couple of things I want to sort of talk about. So the core question which I've sort of started, I want to talk a bit about actuarial paradigms. This is a personal view, and I should publicly offer both thanks and apologies to Richard Fitzherbert for this one. I want to make a couple of comments about control cycles because I think they are valuable, but in general I think we've got them confused. I want to talk about a model for the profession, and that's a broad-based model to build on, and this is where I'd like to start getting some of your comments either now or later. I want to talk about actuarial value, and then I want to finish by talking about complementary skills and a bit about how we can make all this stuff work. So we actually, in my view, out of this potentially get a management tool for the profession, and I think that has the potential to be extremely powerful. So here's the question, and if anybody's got a good answer for this, you know, please let me know, because most of the answers I've heard aren't really very flash. And one observation, compulsion's not a good answer, right? But we do sometimes, as part of the profession, we do hide behind the walls of the statutory castle. And we need to think a little bit about that, because that is hiding behind the walls. That's the compulsion bit. But I think, you know, as I saw someone else say recently, and they were talking in a different context about superannuation, and was actually in the context of liquidity, but you know, the comment was made that many funds say they survived the GFC, to which the response was, survival's a pretty low standard. I think there's an element of that about the statutory castle as well. So here are some suggestions I've heard. Actuaries are clever. Well, we don't have a mortgage on being clever. Much as we might like it. We are a protected species, well, we are to a point. That doesn't actually work very well. There are a lot of protected species that are on the endangered list. And I'm not, it's not entirely flippant. Actuaries add value. Well, that's a good place to go, but then we have to go, so what does value mean? So, and the last point on this slide in particular is, you know, technical expertise, that's a handy tool. Right? And we tend to presume that we've all got it because we go through a rigorous entry examination process. But it's a necessary condition. It's not a sufficient condition. Right? We all know there are lots of actuarial nerds out there. We all know there are lots of nerds in other professions as well. Actuaries don't have a mortgage on being nerds, but they've got a contribution to make. Right? So the technical stuff is a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient. And the issue we're after here is, what's the sufficient condition? So, and I think if you start talking about actuarial value, you hit the first almost stumbling block in terms of the traditional thinking. And the answer is value is in the eyes of the user. It doesn't matter that we think we're valuable. It matters if they think we're valuable. So value is an external perception. Right, so I'm personally tired of sitting around listening to discussions of amongst actuaries and groups in various levels going, we're really clever, we should get this work. Well, the answer is, no, we shouldn't, because all we're doing is gazing at our own navel. The reason we haven't got the work is because we haven't told them that we can do it. And so therefore, I think this is a core issue for the profession to manage, and it's actually a cultural issue. It's not a technical issue. It's about getting out there and promoting it in a constructive manner. Not saying we can be everything to everybody, because we can't. And the danger is, and risk management actually is a great example of this. We're busy saying we're wonderful risk managers. Who's made up a list of all the risks that we're going to manage? All right? Apart from the traditional actuarial ones, and then we sort of close our eyes and forget about the other ones. So, and in those contexts, you know, we run the risk of declining because we turn some of our work into compliance, or it's perceived as compliance. Look at the state of play, at least in some cases, about life insurance financial condition reports. They don't carry the same kudos they used to because they've been turned into a compliance chore, a necessary evil. That's not where we want to be. So the test, right, because all these things need to have a test at the end, how do you evaluate it? And I think there are two tests that come back. One is, do your victims believe that they came away and they got some value? The first question is, did you ever ask them? Right, so that's the first question. And the second question, particularly if you're in a consulting style environment, but I think this applies equally everywhere else, is do they come back? Do they choose to come back? Not because they have to, but do they want to come back? All right, so when you get the phone call from a consulting point of view and it says, oh, remember me, we met 4 years ago and you were working on that, but now I've got a problem, you know, can we have the euphemistic cup of coffee? You know at that point they've come back and you know that you gave, they believed you gave them value. So you can test this stuff. So in terms of doing that, now I'm going to want to stop and I want to look at a bit what, in my view at least, and it's an initial view, what makes us actuaries? And I think it's a combination of things. So this is my personal view on actuarial paradigm. So I'm not talking about syllabus, I'm talking about probably should have the word actuarial technical paradigm sitting there. I'll explain, that'll become clear as we go along. And so these are my sort of principles, if you like. And I did actually once, 4 or 5 years ago, go to a conference and they were talking about principles-based regulation. All right, so this is not in this country. And this bloke stood up, he said, I've got 900 principles about how I'm going to regulate the industry. And I stopped and I thought, no, you haven't got 900 principles. Nobody's got 900 principles. All right, you might have 900 details. So when you come to principles, you actually have to get to high-level stuff. So at the moment, I've got a limit of 10, or equally, when it comes to doing presentations, 2 slides. It's another way of doing it. So I hope that most of these words make sense to you, and I'll just sort of skim through and make a couple of observations here. I think that top of the tree is equity. A lot of our things will flow out of it, but I think top of the tree is equity. And equity is tough stuff. I mean, you might not. I find it tough stuff. I do work in unit pricing, so conceptually unit pricing is really easy. Practically, it's really hard. All right? Equity comes into play. And you need to be able to focus on the big picture. That's what the word macro means. So I'm talking long-term group issues. So for instance, just to stay with the unit pricing exercise for a minute, buy-sell spreads are micro and local. Long-term equity is about the long-term process that you go through over years. So you go, don't really care about buy-sell spreads, I care about the other stuff. So you end up making decisions about what's important and what's not. So equity over time, going for, and equity between different groups. Those of you who work in life insurance, the time and groups bit, participating bonuses, right? Sort of standard stuff, actuarial heritage stuff. But it's much more broadly applicable than that. Judgment. Now, you might, I think I said at the beginning, you know, the technical stuff is where you collect a bunch of tools. You go to university or wherever you get, and you do the education. You walk out with this lovely, shiny kit bag of shiny tools to use. Right? Someone tells you which theorem to plug in, you can plug it in. The question here isn't about the tools. The question here is about knowing which tool to go and use. And a simple analogy for that is it's one thing to have passed the course in building a house. Right? You know that you put these things down first and you put those things in and all that sort of stuff. It's quite another thing to be stuck on a building site and go, here's a pile of building materials, I'm back in 3 months, build me the house. Right? That's the distinction between tools and the use of the tools. And it has all sorts of other trade-offs as well. And I've put in here what I've called a sense of consequence. This is the, if I do this, then what'll happen? Next year or whatever. So it's thinking further down the track. Materiality, we all know a bit about that, but the key thing about materiality is it tells you what to focus on and what not to focus on, probably the more important question. Perspective, actuaries work in the long term. Now, you could be a little bit and be a little bit unfair and say, you know, the accountant's time span is 6 months, because on average it's halfway to the end of the financial year. That's not entirely fair, but it's a different perspective. Actuary's perspective, we're talking years. Superannuation, Darren Wickham was talking before lunch, tens and twenties of years. It's a different view on the world. You have, in a long-term future view, you have what some people call nicely the cone of uncertainty going out. Other people called it something nasty, like the cone of awfulness. Okay, but you have uncertainty. Anybody who, from an actuarial point of view, puts out a result that only has one number in it, from a distributional point of view, if you only put out the mean, you don't put out the mean and some measure of dispersion, you know, for long-term stuff, you're failing. And think how often we do in actuarial where we put out what the answer is. So we don't know what the answer is in the future. But we're not very good at going, here's our best stab and here's the variation around it. But we ought to be. We ought to be doing that without even thinking about it as you go forward. The last one on this page is one that's come up in a number of cases, both here and elsewhere, and it's a skill that actuaries are credited with, and it's synthesis. Right, it's bringing stuff together. It's the holistic approach, if you like. It's about breadth. It's about bridging between different things. It's about balancing. Right? This is a difficult thing to get to. Everybody gets better as they go along with a bit of luck. Okay, but this is a deep and powerful thing to do because it also ties back into materiality and do I care or do I not? So that's five. Assumption setting. Best estimate of margins, everybody in this room, I hope we got, that's blindingly obvious. All right? Go down to an organisation that's conservative and say, please set your assumptions, and they'll go, oh yeah, we'll have this one over here. And you go, how'd you get that? Well, they said, well, we think we've got this, but we'll put a bit in extra. And you say, how much extra did you put in? Oh, we don't know, we just put some extra in. So you transit, you do an exercise of transiting from implicit to explicit by saying, what's your best estimate? Put your money where your mouth is, about 50% up and 50% down, or whichever way the 50% goes. And then put your money in where your mouth is, about to find the margin. Sounds really simple, but culturally it is really hard to do. Now, the life insurance industry spent 5 years after we introduced the 1995 Act getting its head around that. And other people haven't got there yet. Quantification. All right, we do modelling, we do financial impacts. Keyword is financial. Magic word of uncertainty gets back in the game again. And I think the last three are also equally important, that the actuarial profession in general, when you're working as actuaries, you are an advisor to the decision makers. It's rare that you're an actuary and you're the decision maker. Right? You're an influencer, you put out stuff in context, it's important, but you are an advisor. Right? That's not the decision maker. It's not your call. It's your influence, but it's not your call. The process, I've put down actuarial practice and control. I'll talk a little bit more about this in a second because I have a personal view on this. And public interest, this is being trusted for the greater good. And I think that is a core thing for the profession. It's something to be taken and to be treasured. And we are known for it. It's one of these wonderful things that's easy to lose and hard to get. So, you know, my view on that is don't mess it up. So, talk a little bit about control cycles here. A couple of quick observations. They're not new. Right? They're not actuarial. They're called feedback loops. You know, a few other professions have them. Engineers have them. Biologists have them. And they've had them for a long time. So, they are, however, enshrined in legislation. From the actuarial point of view, it's called a financial condition report. Right? So it's a wonderful example of how these things can come to pass. But as a friend of mine once said, he made the point that, no, they're not actuarial. You could quite happily define a control cycle for a plumber. And he did, which didn't go down very well in the actuarial meeting, but it, it made the point. So why is this caught on? And I'm going to offer you a suggestion as to why it's caught on, which is enshrined in the next two slides. The first thing is what I call, if anybody's been to University of Melbourne, done actuarial control cycle, you will have seen this ad nauseam. Right? The first one's called the analytic cycle. Right? Known to its friends as the techie cycle. This is how you go about building models and solving problems. You work out what the issue is, specify it. That's not necessarily easy. Then you go and do it. And then you go and see whether it worked or not. And then you go and do it all over again. Right? Notice that it's a cycle. But that's a techie, that's a, you know, heads down, bums up working cycle. So, whilst it's broadly applicable, you know, so here's an example of how you can apply it to governance and risk management. Policy is working out what you want to do. Implementation, that's doing it. Monitoring, well, that's internal audit, external audit, risk management, change control, pick all those things. And you should, in my view, be able, in any problem you apply this to, be able to take each of those six arrows and attach to each one of them specific actions. So in terms of making this process work, I'm doing this to deal with this arrow, I'm doing that to deal with that arrow, and so on. And my suggestion is, if you can't assign specific actions to each arrow, you don't understand it well enough. That's the test on using it. So it's a generic process. This is completely non-specific to content. And, however, models, unfortunately for actuaries who love models, they live in the real world and they live in a real context. So you have to put this in an environment where we've got professionalism, do it properly, peer review, good stuff, governance, right, which includes risk management in the broad sense of the word. Bottom on the left, implement it. You know, it's one thing to know what you're going to do. It's another thing to go and do it. It's a skill in its own right. And you have to put it in the context of the environment. And I call that the professional cycle. That's how you keep all those models under control. Any of you who've worked in an environment where you're using models on a production level basis, you will know, I hope, that keeping the model current and knowing it's doing what you want it to do is kind of important. You don't want to front up at the end of next year and find that last year's end of year date was hardwired into the model somewhere. Or the spreadsheet, which is probably what most people are using, right? So governance in the local sense and governance in the bigger sense is really important. Yeah, so that's the first step. So there's some actuarial paradigms, and the actuarial control cycle, in my view, should be called the actuarial practice and control cycle. And it's made up of those two parts. They're basic processes that we use. They're subject matter independent. Second part is, how do I start putting all this together? Because I made a few comments at the beginning about inwards and outwards and so on. So now I need to have some sort of framework within which I can start talking about us and them. Right, us good guys and them bad guys. So what I've done is I just started thinking about this, and a lot of the material I found actually relates to education. So I started off at education. And in fact, a lot of the material I found actually sits up over here. This, I was going to put entry gate here, but I thought that might upset people. So I've left the word gate out, but I'll leave it in your thoughts. So at the beginning, lots of technical tools. Okay. Later on, you get more of them because you do CPD. Right. So that's in the ongoing part. But the really important part is what you do with them. And as you go through the initial education process, you start being given some awareness of how to use this. We start talking a bit about professionalism and materiality and all those good things. The terms here, this term normative comes from Claire Bellis's paper 20-odd years ago, talking about professionalism. And it's really about understanding the norms within which you work. I'm using it in the context of how you go about using the tools that you've got at your disposal. So which ones you get out of your kit bag from the point of view of building the house. Now, this hard line here, right, this is your actuarial castle. Right, these are the walls around it. And every now and again you go, we better go and talk to somebody else outside. So you then move through, I'll come back to this experience and capabilities here a bit in a minute, and you go out and you do stuff. And I realised after I made these slides up, this might not have been the best choice of word. So, sorry about that. I mean execution in the sense of doing, not in the sense of dying.
But anyway, so you go and do stuff, and if the stuff you do is any good, you'll go and contribute actuarial value. But you have to go through this process here, from here, to do it. And you have to go and ask the users whether you've done it or not. Okay? So that's for individuals. That's thee and me. Then we look at that. We go, well, we've got a profession here. That's why we're at this conference. So what does the profession contribute in contrast to me? Well, the profession contributes a number of things, but in particular, in a sense, it contributes inside the castle. It's going to contribute the actuarial paradigms. Right? There should be a driving force behind the education process, and it should also be providing some support and leadership as well, but still inside the castle. They just get to be on the top floor of the turrets as opposed to the bottom floor. But the reality is that outside of us, we've got a big bad world out there, and they have needs and demands, and we have an environment, and the profession has a profile. But that sits outside of the castle. So these are the pieces that we need to put together in order to run the profession. And I'll leave you with two thoughts. One is, I think we have potentially an overemphasis here, and we have an underemphasis here. These two ones here, these are the engine room of the profession. This is where we're out doing and learning and feeding back. This, coincidentally, these two are in the middle of the diagram, so it makes it rather nice of them being the centre of the picture and everything else sort of sitting around it, supporting it. I'd love to say I thought of that when I made the diagram. I didn't. It just sort of happened that way. But this is where everything really happens, where it wins and it loses. So let's look at those a little bit more. So this is a graphic made by a non-graphic artist, you can tell. So if I'd done it, had a little more time, I would have had all the arrows come in on separate ones, which would just make up for more slides. So I'm now starting to think about actuarial value. Right, how do I get there? How do I get to that bottom actuarial value box? Well, I've got to start off from a couple of directions. I do need to have... way around does this go? Some basics here. So I start off getting some education, and that does start setting us apart because it's got a different perspective. I then go and get some experience, and I apply some capabilities, which I'll come back to in a moment. These are really important. And in the same context, I've got my actuarial paradigms coming in, my principles. This is after I've done it a couple of times, so don't worry about that so much. And so I go and do some execution. And I'll come back and talk about this in a little more detail as well. But it's carefully set up. There are two parts to this. And if I'm really going to go and add value, I go and get a new set of paradigms here. These are these what I've called business paradigms. This is what the users want. Not what we want to give them, but what they want us to give them. And if I can combine good execution and I can combine the business paradigms, then I'm going to start giving real value. And one way of thinking of all these things is they're a chain, right? Chains have links in them. And I have to make sure that every link in the chain is going to work. Otherwise, I don't get to actuarial value. So wherever that chain breaks, that's my limiting point. I've stopped at that point. So just to put a couple of... where is it gone? These into context. The capabilities. I've looked at these and talked to a number of people and plagiarised left, right and centre. But there's a sort of number of dimensions to this. Personal skills and values, right? It's called integrity, okay? Courage of convictions, right? Or don't roll over. And we've all seen examples of that where that's come under stress. Professionalism, this is peer review, standards, all those sorts of things, right? Includes discipline from the profession. Because right? You've got to make sure if you've got the game rules that you abide by them. They're there usually for a good reason. Communication. Right? How good's the report? If you write a report about something non-technical, can you give it to your spouse? And once she's read it, she goes, I actually understood that. If you can do that, you've done really well. If it's technical and it's got numbers in it, maybe all bets are off. But that's what you should be aiming for. If you don't communicate... right, it's not actually, if you don't communicate, it's not that they didn't listen. The reality is if you don't communicate, you might as well not have done the work. You have wasted your time if you don't communicate. And he tried standing up in front of 40 or 50 students and saying, if you send me the assignment and I don't get the message, you didn't do it. No, it's sort of, you know, the eyes unglaze for a moment. You know, you have their attention. But that's the net state of the play. Business management, right, this is being part of an organisation, understanding how to interact. Whole set of skills that work there. Right? As an individual, you may not be very good at it, but if you're working in an organisation and you're not good at it, your chain just broke. Business understanding. You know, where is the business going? Not where are you going, but where are they going? And of course, at the bottom, you've got experience. I mean, the reality is you always learn much more by making a mistake than by getting it right. So you've got to go out and make a few mistakes. Hopefully someone will bail you out and keep going. So those are the sorts of things that sit in there in the terms of capabilities. And in the terms of the users, I've split this up into two pieces because traditional actuarial advice, so that's pricing and all that sort of good stuff, and the statutory roles and the interaction with other professionals, in a sense, they live just outside the castle. You can sort of put the drawbridge down and nip across to the gatehouse and do them, and you can run back home again. Right? They're familiar and they're safe and they're established. But if you want to go and add value, then you need to go to that bottom four. That's where that green arrow coming in from business skills, business paradigms on the prior slide comes. It comes in for those bottom four. Right? Where's the business going? Outside the actuarial department. How do you fit? And I've stolen from the SOA have a list of 8 capabilities they've put up on their website recently. And one of those capabilities is result-oriented solutions. And I thought it was quite useful because it's not only solutions, it's the fact they're result-oriented solutions. Right? You give a test at the end and you say, here's how you go. And then I think you start giving actuarial business advice. That's when you start. This is where you get dangerous. Right? It's where you get useful and it's where you should be able to earn the big bucks. So in summary, just putting it in words, I've got a little pictorial diagram here. I'll just scan down it because I'm going to get in trouble in a minute, aren't I, Leslie? Oops, hang on, didn't work. So I start off, got a problem or an issue, apply some tools, develop a model, analytic cycle, first sort of use of it. Then I have to govern the model. I have to know what I'm doing. You know, it's not go down and pick up the spreadsheet from 12 months ago and spend 3 days working out what you were doing then. You know, no one's done that, right? And you apply the actuarial paradigm, so assumptions and all that stuff. I'm governed by the professional cycle. Still in the castle. Got what you might call an actuarial control cycle at that point. Actually haven't done very much that's really actuarial, so apply it to the financial services, but anywhere else as well. Nothing particularly special. I then start getting actuarial control, is the phrase I've used. Start adding in those capabilities and the experience, that normative bit, and I get to actuarial practice. So I'm just drawing these parts apart. And then I'm going to deliver relevant, right, as in they think it, timely, so in time, before the event happens, and respected advice. That's what we all want to do. Right? There's nothing special about that. Then I've given actuarial value. But if I break any one of those chains, then I'm getting less value or no value. So there's a paradigm sitting in all these pieces here and in how you fill in those little blocks around the capabilities and the business interaction. And those are the things where I think we have the opportunity to both sort ourselves out and to understand how we interact with other professions. Because for other professions, of which there are a few we might interact with, and perhaps more we would like to interact with, so let's make a list of them. The question we have to ask is, you know, why would I use one of me as opposed to one of them? Still the original question. I've now just got a framework in which I can answer it. Well, start asking, how do I do this? Well, I've got my set of paradigms, sort of how I work. The other professions will have their sets of paradigms too, and there will be some intersections and there'll be some gaps. As I said before, it's not a game of who wins and who loses or who has more or who has less. It's a game of working out where my strengths meet your strengths, the other professions, and where my strengths complement your strengths, or I've got a tick and you haven't, and vice versa. So conceptually what I've got is a really easy process here. All right? I draw up a nice two-dimensional matrix. Professions down the side, if you like. Paradigms across the top. Ticks and crosses. And I come along to my role. I come along to an employer. I come along to the institute and I go, I want to deal with the following project which has needs of following capabilities. Well, I just look up the columns and go, well, I'll have one actuary over here and I'll have an accountant from over there and I'll take something else from over here. And if I line them all up, all the boxes I need to have ticked will be ticked. And away I go. So at that stage, all right, what I now have is I've got the opportunity to pick up some benefits in a structure that I can go and manage, because I can go and say, well, I'd like that link in the chain to be stronger. I'd like to develop these capabilities because I know how they fit in. What happens? Well, for an individual, I can start assessing the gaps and I can make some choices. I don't have to make every individual be perfect and do everything, but I can make a conscious choice of, I'm not going down that link of the chain, I'm going to go over here. Because there are some people who are really good at being inside the castle and they're great at it, and we should encourage that. There are some people who aren't very good at being inside the castle. They should be out, you know, somewhere over here, running around being scouts or something. Right? And they're good at that. So the strengths, horses for courses. So you can understand your needs. You can understand your users' perspectives with a bit of luck when you're interacting with other professions, because you get some insight into how they work. And therefore, as you go along, you can start delivering some real value. That's at the individual level. Now, from the professions point of view, that third column, I can use the same process, except now what I'm doing is I'm using it at an aggregate level. So I'm getting the real sort of typical average actuary, mythical beast. So I'm doing it from the professions point of view. Well, now I've got some targets for my entry education process. I've got some targets for my CPD, because I know where these guys, this mythical average actuary, is going. I can market the profession now, because I now know what I've got on offer and how I complement others, so I can market it to employers, I can market it to all the other users, governments and everybody else. So I've got a marketing tool, and in my view at least, it highlights the need to focus on CPD. Now, the analogy I've heard used is getting into the profession is a bit like getting a driver's license, and that's when you're really dangerous. Okay, so what you need to do is to get in, get the driver's license, then you need to go and learn how to use it. And this gives, I would suggest anyway, and you may have a different view, this gives us a path through to work out how we can start doing some of the assessment of those steps and working out what steps we would like to take. So I'm done for a minute.
Great. Thank you very much, Jules. That's really interesting talk there, looking at the defining the value, first of all, of the actuarial profession. How do we promote the value of actuaries to the outside world? And maybe looking at some changes in the education and professionalism courses and education that happens already to enable actuaries to demonstrate their value to the outside world. Very much welcome comments, discussion, criticism,
No tomatoes,
no bread rolls. If you could come up to the microphone, please, and state your name first, because it's being recorded. Thank you.
So, I'm Maria de Nazaré Barroso from Portugal, and I have a comment. I am from Portugal. Portugal is a small country in the European Union, and now we have the directive on Solvency II. You all are aware of Solvency II, I think, even if you are not in Europe. And this directive, it does not mention the word actuary, but the actuarial function. And at least in theory, this actuarial function can be done by any person who has the skills, the technical skills, and it is not an actuary. I think that from 2013 onwards, when this directive will be on place, we need to do the marketing of the profession and to go to possible employers and other stakeholders to explain what the value of an actuary is. Why to employ an actuary instead of a statistician or a mathematician or some other profession. I'm most on agreement of all the paradigms you presented, but some of them are common to other professions.
Agreed. But not all of them.
So perhaps the long term is one that can be adequate to describe actuaries. But if I go to explain the value based on this paradigm, I will go to that joke, what's the difference between an actuary and God? That you know.
Oh, not much, but...
Do you know what's the difference between an actuary and God?
Tell me your answer.
God never said he was an actuary. That's it. So I would like to have your input about what we can do to make a better marketing of the profession and to explain what is the value that actuaries can bring.
In a sense, that's the universal question. It's the question I'm working with, in a sense, as well. What I've tried to do here is to articulate a process which I can use to define the value of an actuary. I'm not actually prepared to claim that actuaries are very close to God. And I think there are plenty of other things, you know, you could put into a picture of this ilk which cover all sorts of other professions, and we're not even close to it. So it's not an ambit claim for we're perfect or we're universal. I think the next step in doing this in terms of saying why an actuary and why not someone else, and therefore what does an actuary bring, is actually to make up that... where am I going? Going the other way. To make up this grid, where you are able to go and say in a legitimate manner, for example, take auditors, for example, just pick on someone. You know, here's a set of 8 or 10 generic skills, the same sort of style that I had for actuarial skills, and I accept they might need some external translation. But just take for a moment, we understand those, and let's take for a moment, we agree with them. If you line up and look at accountants and auditors, you get a different set of skills. And once we can identify what that different set is... I mean, for example, auditors in particular are really strong on process and controls. Okay? Actuaries aren't that strong on it. So now I've got a useful difference in perspective that I can take to a user of skills, be it a regulator or an insurance company, and I can go, well, if you want to run a good valuation process, you're going to need the following set of skills, of which processes and controls would be one. Actuaries don't necessarily do that, but if you put them in line with actuaries and an auditor or someone with that skill set, then you get a complete process. So I'm looking at this and thinking that where we're going to end up with is here. As potentially as leading teams, but not necessarily, but participating in teams, and you end up with a process where the sum of the parts, the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts. And I think what I'm proposing is this process of making explicit, right? List down what those attributes are and then have a debate about them. Don't sit up there and go, we've got lots of skills. Well, everybody's got lots of skills, but what are they? So it's a process here of making explicit, putting our money where our mouth is, and then working out how we work best with others. And that tells us where our hinterlands are for actuarial work. And it tells us where the new fields are, where we might be able to, but we're not doing it now. And it also tells us a place, don't go there. So I think the process is working through that make explicit exercise.
Can I ask carried linears. But Jules, I wonder if you can just go back to that model one, just because I like seeing you go back and forth.
Then went the wrong way anyway. Got it wrong.
I think it's a really good model, but and I know that you said, you know, education is part of that process.
That one?
But yeah. But I think, you know, if you're really looking to, I think this can apply to a lot of professions.
Yes.
You know, I think they have a similar sort of process. And
yes.
Other than actuarial value, it adds up to accounting value or Agreed. Whatever down the bottom.
Yep.
So where I think one of the real big differences are is in education, only in the sense of
here?
If you look at the topics, the material that's taught and where the skill set, the tools are derived,
yes.
It's what differentiates an accountant from an actuary is what they learn in the course.
Yeah, and I would argue that potentially what's driving that is these things here.
That should be driving what's in the education.
Yes.
But the education also, you know, clearly there's a mathematical bias in
yes.
that's probably beyond what an accountant would do in terms of mathematics.
Why, because it's got multiplications in it?
Yeah.
Okay.
They do pluses and minuses. You know, but we probably don't, like, we touch on a lot of areas that other professions, you know, might become specialists
yes.
in. So that communication between, you know, having that little bit of knowledge of each of those
yes.
skills means that we can probably
yep.
pick up what they're talking
yep.
about and then communicate and bring it together.
Back here.
So I think there's, like, I think the model is good, but I think it's really the difference is in what we learn compared to what is taught in the other courses of other professions. And if you start there, you'll be able to pick up the differences between what tools they have and therefore what are the paradigms that they've been encouraged to acquire.
I think I partly agree with you in terms of going back and looking at the education processes, and that gives you an insight into what they do. I think I also partly disagree in the sense that I think one of the core things that we have as actuaries is this capacity here.
Yeah.
And I think that's bigger than, that sits above the tools, if you like.
But I think that comes about because of the breadth of the course material that we cover. Because we cover such a broad range, it
yep.
means that we can, you know, distill what the issue is and look through it. But the other thing is, I think that how I see it in going back to that model, over the last 20 years, if you go back 20 years ago,
yep.
I think the model was a little bit different, that basically you've got experience on the job, and so it sort of came down
yes.
to that first pillar.
There,
experience and capabilities fell down below, so you had education, awareness, experience and capabilities all being gained at the same time. Now most
yes.
people are going through the university system, so this model now falls out this way. But
so yes, I think this line here, if you like, has come down. I think it's actually a legitimate question as to how far down it should come.
Well, I think it's that experience and capabilities box has moved across.
What, from here to here?
Whereas I think previously you were getting it as part of your education process.
Oh, okay, because you were working on the job, in effect. Yeah, okay. So they've sort of been split out.
Yeah. So I think this discussion now, again, that's why I think it becomes now more about the education compared to in the past where you were actually picking up experience and capabilities on the job.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I'm happy with that. Andrew.
Andrew Gower. Firstly, I remember Richard Fitzherbert once getting up and at a Melbourne president's address and saying, we had no paradigms. So
yeah.
you've done a pretty good job of coming up with some.
I've got to be right, or at least get some general agreement on it. But
well, some of them I totally agree with, some I might not, but generally you've done a pretty good job with them. It's actually interesting, some of the other discussions we've had and the discussions I've been involved in over my 10 years of working, and we've just had, just before lunch, we had a session on doing FCRs for superannuation funds, coming very much so in the compulsion. And it almost, that discussion was much around, let's get actuaries in there in a compulsion methodology sort of thing, rather than looking at what's the value, and rather than the users saying, I want to go and get an actuary for this. Another side of that has been the discussion in banking, and I've recall probably 4 or 5 years ago when banking was the hot topic
mm-hmm.
of having appointed actuaries in banks.
That'd be a good idea.
Yeah, but once again, it's just compulsion, not user saying that there's value.
Well, sometimes it's a chicken egg in that, because the user realises value after you've compelled them to do it.
Yes.
But they don't necessarily realise there's value beforehand, because it means they've got to change and they've got other things to do.
Yes. Yes, I totally agree with that comment. I think another interesting point which will come out of the European experience with Solvency 2, the definition of the actuarial function rather than being an actuary means that we as a profession, like the Europeans will have to focus on it in the next couple of years, but we as a profession will have to focus on how do we sell ourselves.
Yeah, and I think there's a very important point that comes up in that, which is taking the European experience. They're going to have an actuarial function, right? There's no debate they're going to have an actuarial function, right? Let's get that clear. The only debate is going to be who does it. And as the profession, we've got a choice, and we've seen this in a variety of cases both here and there. The debate had around FCRs for general insurance, right? Our choice is whether we're going to fill that gap or not. Not whether the gap is going to be filled. So we can, as a profession, we actually have to make a conscious decision of either we're going to adopt the view we can do it, give it to us, you know, and we'll go out and we'll work, you know, if we haven't got it clean now, we'll work it out as we go. Or we can take the other view, which is, oh, I can't do a perfect solution, so I won't do it. All right? And that, to me, at least to go back for those in history, was essentially the debate that sat around FCRs and general insurance. To be frank, I was absolutely gobsmacked. How can you be in a position of having the capabilities to go and do something when someone gives you the opportunity to then go, oh, shit, I might not be able to do it perfectly, so maybe I won't do it. So, you know, there's a cultural shift sitting in here as well for the actuarial profession. The opportunity is being made by having Solvency II actuarial function. Well, you better start putting the hands up and going, we can. Because if we don't, somebody else will. All right? And you need to make no mistake about that.
That was what I was going to end on, basically, of in 5 years' time, will the appointed actuary need to be an actuary in a life insurance company here in Australia? And it may not be 5 years, it may be 10 or 15, but at some point, the actuarial function will be done by other people.
Oh, and a lot of the individual bits can be. So the question is picking up on these differences that make us, as Carrie said, the breadth, the synthesis, those things, which are sort of their next level skill sets up from the mere tools. And not to say the mere tools are unimportant, but as I said before, and they're the necessary things. It's the sufficient things that we need to be after. Right? And we're a small profession and we need to, you know, be quite aggressive about it.
At risk of putting my back to Andrew, I just want to be able to see a few people as well. Is that okay? Martin Mulcair. Firstly, Jules, thank you for raising the topic. I think it's absolutely perfect to have this type of subject at a convention, because it's absolutely cool, of course. And in my naivety, I was expecting a lot more people would be interested in such a topic, but I've been accused of being naive before. I just want to do two things.
I'm just glad somebody came.
Two things. Firstly, let me have an attempt at answering your question.
Okay.
Question, you know, why an actuary rather than somebody else? I would say my answer would be that, and this may not apply to the role, but I'd say if you want somebody who can provide insight into the future with reference to the past, considering the financial implications and fairness principles.
That's not bad.
That's when you want an actuary.
Yeah.
Okay, that's my
take. That's a good mission statement for... might borrow that. It's a good mission statement for the lower-level discussion.
The second thing I'd like to do is ask a different question. Now, I'm a fan of value propositions, and I'm also conscious we've got the new marketing manager at the back who actually knows a bit about marketing, rather than people like me who make it up. But I love value propositions, and so if we actually, and I also want to ask you, and I'm sure this happens regularly for you people who get out, when people say, what do you do, or what do actuaries do, how do you answer? I know we've, you know, 30 people brought 30 different answers, but some people go to the way Carrie thought about it. They describe in terms of what we learn, right, or our tools. Some would describe in terms of what we do. But I like value propositions that are more about outcomes. Mm-hmm. Right? So what do actuaries do for society as a kind of society value proposition would be an interesting question.
And that gets you out down this sort of column here.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's why I'm... Now, I'm indebted to Greg Martin, who in his presidential address a few years ago, he had an attempt at this.
Mm-hmm.
And I took his words and amended them. All right? So this is what I think. This is what I think that actuaries do in terms of value proposition with outcomes. All right? The other thing about value propositions, yeah, outcome-oriented, but also a bit aspirational. So I think what actuaries do, and this is an Australian one, Philly Sudet, but that actuaries help Australian financial institutions to be sound and sustainable.
I'm fine with that.
Now, what I also changed when I gave my feedback to Greg was that what if you took out financial, especially this convention where we're going beyond the mandate, what if we took out financial and replaced it with important? And so, therefore, see how, you take your own version of this, but I'll just put it to you to think about next time someone says, what do actuaries do? You said, actuaries help Australia's important institutions to be sound and sustainable. You might get people's attention at the party.
Yeah. I agree with that. And I think the only observation I make is those are wonderful and valid, if you like, mission statements, aspirational statements. The next question that will come is, how do you do it? And I was more focused on trying to get to the next level down about how I can do it, how I can decide whether I'm doing it or not, because I think I've got to be able... You've got to be able to implement the vision. So the vision's the 5% fun bit. It's the academic bit and prove the theorem, right? And that's important. But you've got to do the 95%, which is the grunt work. And that's equally important.
Thank you. We're almost out of time. I can sense the bell about to ring any second. Are there any final brief comments or questions that somebody would like to ask? No? Great. Please fill in your feedback forms. If you haven't got one, there's some spare ones here. And if I could ask for a volunteer from the back row. Thank you, volunteer from the back row, who will not let you out until you hand over your feedback forms.
Oh.
So without more ado, I'd also like to thank Jules in the usual way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.